Support for agricultural programs comes from AgriGold, celebrating their 13th year as a major corporate underwriter of Illinois Public Media's ag programming and e-newsletter. AgriGold's support allows their customers and growers everywhere to receive quality ag information at no charge. More information on AgriGold can be found at AgriGold.com.
From the Land-Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It is Tuesday, the 8th day of March 2016. I'm Todd Gleason, away from the office, of course, at the All-Day Ag Outlook. In fact, we should have just wrapped up a really great day there. Folks are in their vehicles on the way home, and we have something special for them. Scott Irwin dropped by my office on Monday, and we talked about an article that he and Daryl Good posted to the Farm Doc Daily website that really stirred quite a buzz. It's talking about the expectations for the 2016 average corn yield as it relates to El Nino and what history might tell us about this coming growing season. Stay with us. You don't want to miss this Tuesday edition of the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
As you might expect, no numbers for this afternoon, but I do have some updates for you. First, from the Farm Doc Daily website, as it's related to crop insurance, there is an article there that was posted by Bruce Sherrick and Gary Schnitke. You'll want to make sure that you check it out before you make your decisions for crop insurance this year. Speaking of which, to help you make those decisions, there are a set of tools online, and you can find them on the Farm Doc Daily website. It's farmdocdaily.illinois.edu. On the right-hand side of the page, as you scroll down, you'll see a box under U of I Extension that says Announcements. You're looking for Explore All Tools. It's a blue tab, Explore All Tools. Under the U of I Extension logo, in the box that says Announcements, Explore All Tags, you're looking for those tools. You can go online and those tools will help you make your crop insurance decisions. This Friday, I will be out of the office again, emceeing the Illinois Soybean Summit that's to be held in Rockford. And if you're interested in going, you can still manage to get yourself registered. This should be a great event. We kick off at around 7 o'clock, at least opening the doors, and starting up around 8:15. The first general session is with Bryce Anderson from DTN. He's going to take a look at the weather, and then Bryce Knorr from Farm Progress will take a look at the 2016 growing season, what the profits might be, and what your marketing decisions will look like. So it should be a great day. In Rockford, Illinois, with the Soybean Summit, you can find out all the details there online at ilsoy.org. Make sure you get yourself registered. That one's free, and you can do it right now. Again, the address is ilsoy.org.
Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible by Farm Credit Illinois, lending support to generations of farm families for 100 years. Whether a young farmer or a seasoned grower, Farm Credit Illinois offers financial products and services geared specifically to the agricultural community.
Our term for the day is speculate. Speculation is the practice of engaging in risky financial transactions in an attempt to profit from short or medium-term fluctuations in the market value of a tradable good, rather than attempting to profit from the underlying attributes embodied in the instrument. Many speculators pay little attention to the fundamental value of a security or a commodity, and instead focus purely on price movements. Speculation can, in principle, involve any tradable good or financial instrument. Speculators are particularly common in the market for stocks, bonds, commodity futures, currencies, fine art, collectibles, real estate, and derivatives. Speculators play one of four primary roles in financial markets, along with hedgers who engage in transactions to offset some other pre-existing risk. Arbitrageurs who seek to profit from situations where fungible instruments trade at different prices in different market segments, and investors who seek profit through long-term ownership of instruments' underlying attributes. The role of speculators is to absorb excess risk that other participants do not want, and to provide liquidity in the marketplace by buying or selling when no participants from other categories are available. Successful speculation entails collecting an adequate level of monetary compensation in return for providing immediate liquidity and assuming additional risk so that, over time, the inevitable losses are offset by larger profits. And that's the definition of speculation.
Agricultural programs are made possible by Risk Management Commodities Incorporated, headquartered in Lafayette, Indiana, with branches in Chalmers, Indiana, and Hudsonville, Illinois, providing independent commodity, financial, and currency analysis to its clients and newsletter subscribers. On the web at myrmconline.com.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media on this Tuesday afternoon. It is the 8th day of March. I'm out of the office, of course, at the Beef House in Covington, Indiana. We should have just finished up a fantastic day. And for those who are now in their vehicles on the way home, one more thing to listen to. Have you thought about the impact of the El Nino on the coming growing season and what that really means? Well, the agricultural economist here on campus at the U of I have, and we're now joined by Scott Irwin. He and Daryl Good wrote an article for the Farm Doc Daily website, posted it last week on the second day of March, called Forming Expectations for the 2016 U.S. Average Corn Yield. What about El Nino? And it really has caused, Scott Irwin, quite a fervor in the marketplace. Once in a while, you post an article that you really get some kind of reaction from folks, but this one really hit a nerve, I think, didn't it?
Seems like everybody's got a strong opinion about El Nino and corn yields.
So tell me about the marketplace and the article that you've written. You went back and did a whole lot of history to begin with to get at what the impact of weather, in this case El Nino, has been historically, not in just the short term, but over quite a long period of time.
That's right. We went back 56 years to 1960, and we started off by updating our trend yield estimate from last year, and then asked how we might alter our trend yield expectation based on knowledge of the El Nino event that's ongoing.
So tell me about the historical yields and patterns to kind of set the stage.
Right. We use a long-term trend. Our argument is that the technological rate of improvement in corn yields in the U.S. in aggregate has been remarkably stable for over five decades, that corn yields have increased a little bit over 1.8 bushels per year, going all the way back into the early 1960s. There's always a lot of debate about, is that increasing? Some people a few years ago thought it was decreasing. Daryl and I think that we should stick with the long run. And when we put all the numbers together, that gives us a trend yield for 2016 of 166.2 bushels per acre.
Yeah, and so the 166.2 is actually, is it just slightly lower than one of the other trends that you use? So it's 164 plus an adjustment, is that right?
Right, right. So literally, if you just take the yields for the last 56 years, run a straight line through those yields to represent trend, and then just project one more year with that straight line, that's actually 164.2. But we've done some other research over the years with crop weather models, and it turns out that there's a slight bias to your trend coefficient estimate if you don't account for this asymmetry of weather effects that we see in corn and that every corn farmer knows in their bones, which is that good weather helps you less than bad weather hurts your yields. And that rolls through these statistical modeling, gives you a slight downward bias. So we adjust up the 164.2 to 166.2 as our final estimate of what the true trend yield should be for the U.S. on average.
So then you have to put it all back together with the trend and the deviations over time. And
right.
What does that look like so that we can get closer to where we're headed?
That's right. Because obviously, there are very few years when yields turn out to be exactly equal to trend because the trend forecast is basically assuming average weather. And do we very often get truly average weather? No, it's typically either better than average or sometimes much worse than average. And so that gives us dramatic deviations normally. So we wouldn't expect to actually get 166.2 next year, but that's the best you can project based on assuming no knowledge of what the growing season weather will be.
You mentioned that the expectation is for yields to be normal, and that the good yields don't help as much as the bad yields hurt, but bad yields don't appear as often, is my gut feeling.
And that's exactly right. It's kind of a round number, but think of it this way, Todd. About 60% of the time, yields are above trend, and about 40% of the time, they're below trend. And you would think, well, that can't work, because don't those deviations have to add up to zero? Yes, they do. What we see in the data makes a lot of sense, is that the negative deviations below trend tend to be larger than the positive deviations, so that they still add up to zero. Kind of the best way, I think, to see that is just look at the extremes. And according to our figures, the largest deviation positive above trend was in 2004 at about 18 bushels. And can still remember it, really good year for growing corn in the U.S. But in 2012, just the opposite, we were, I believe, 33 bushels below trend. So you can see that not quite twice as big of an extreme for the downside compared to the upside.
Okay. So,
so
now,
that's normal. That's normal.
Now we understand the normal. We understand the deviation and the trend and what the expectation would be. Then you have to also understand the oscillation from La Nina to El Nino,
right,
and definitions of both, actually.
Yeah. So the real question is then, so we see 166.2 is what we project, and then we know that there's this range of possible deviations from the 166.2, from a really good year like 2004 to a really terrible year like 2012, and that's kind of what we call, in statistical terms, the unconditional risk, yield risks that we face going forward. And now what we want to ask is, should we skew our expectation of those risks given this outside factor that doesn't happen every year, which we call El Nino?
And should we?
Bottom line is, jumping ahead, yes. That's what our research suggests, somewhat. So what we did is went back to, what is exactly an El Nino? Lots of people probably already know this, but it's a complex climatological effect. But ultimately, what it really is warming temperature of waters on the surface of the Pacific near the equator. And it's kind of fascinating. Although it's widely, widely studied, we really don't understand why these El Nino, La Nina cycles have occurred. We now know they've been around for thousands, maybe tens of thousands or longer years. But what we're just now in the last couple of decades beginning to appreciate is the dramatic effects on short-run weather that these cycling of the sea surface temperature around the equator in the Pacific can have when they're warmer than average or colder than average. And that's the cycling between what is called El Nino and La Nina conditions out in the Pacific.
And we base that on centigrade. And I thought it was unique when I was reading through the article that Indonesia seems to be the place that takes the brunt of the impact. Mm-hmm. Either they have a lot of rain or don't have a lot of rain, depending on whether we're in a strong El Nino or a strong La Nina.
Right.
And this oscillates, but it has impacts across other parts of the world, including here, potentially in the Midwest. So I think we're now at the point where we can begin to talk about what the growing season might look like in the United States. And we can, again, use that based on historical factors.
Right. So, all right, that all sounds really simple, right? But digging into it, we found out there are two things that you have to think about. One, exactly how are you going to define an El Nino event? There's basically two kinds of El Niño variables. One that is most straightforward and most people use is strictly a function of the water temperature near the equator in the Pacific in two specific regions. Other measures take into account air pressure and other variables for these kind of composite indicators. Looking into it, we have a preference for keeping it as simple as we can. And so we strictly focused on measures of that are based strictly on water temperature, which are measured, as I understand it, by buoys out there in the Pacific that measure the water temperature. And it's been set up by various scientific agencies. And so that's the measure that we're looking at to determine it. And the standard definition of an El Niño is when the temperature for three consecutive months running on average is at least half a degree centigrade above the average norm for that area. And inversely, you have what's called a La Niña when you're at least a half a centigrade below the average temperature in that region. And so that's how you define an El Niño or a La Niña.
How many times does this happen then?
Oh, a lot. If you look at...
The pattern's what, every 6 years? 6 to 7?
Again, that depends. Now you get into the second part of the definition. Because there's a lot of El Niños and La Niñas using the half a degree threshold. So what we were interested in is, so what we did is basically just plotted the data for these temperature anomalies, as they're called. And naturally, we think that the data is most interesting in the extremes. So that's what we did. We limited our attention to what I would call El Niño spikes, the really big El Niño phenomenon. So we decided to only look at El Niño episodes that were at least 1 degree centigrade above the average temperature. So it could be 1 degree or more warmer than normal. And the warmest one was to date was 1997-98, and it peaked at 2.3 degrees centigrade above normal. So when we take the same period, we estimated trend yields. If you look going back to 1960, there were 11 El Niño episodes where we were at least 1 degree centigrade above normal. And this is the other key. We filtered the data so that these spikes had to occur in what we called the preseason period for corn production. So from September of the calendar year previously through March, we're looking for basically a spike of a big El Niño. And that's exactly what we're experiencing this year. We don't have final data yet. It looks like the current El Niño is spiking. It's peaked in either December or January near 2.3 or 2.4 degrees above normal. So it's a really big one. And it occurred in the preseason period. And then we asked, okay, is there anything systematic between that occurrence and the deviation above or below trend that we experienced the next summer?
And did you find anything?
We think we did. Again, it's not definitive. Every one of these things is a little bit different in how they occur. But basically what we find is that in these big spiking El Niños that occur in the preseason period, that in corn, on average, you end up about 4 to 5 bushels below trend on average. But having said that, there's quite a range of occurrences. There are instances of these big preseason El Niño spikes where you actually end up fairly substantially above trend. One year, I recall, I think it was 1992, you ended up, I believe, 11 bushels above trend. And you also see other years that are in there that are, you know, kind of the big ones that we talk about. And the ones that people really pay attention to are 1982-83 was one of those big spikes in the preseason El Nino, and we ended up 23 bushels below trend. And of course, there's 87-88, which is the second biggest deviation after 2012. There are other years there that, you know, range from small positive to smaller negative deviations. But on average, you know, the data say that your expectation based on the kind of El Nino that we're currently experiencing, you would want to certainly take into consideration what we call elevated risks of below trend yields. It's not a sure thing, but the data clearly point in that direction.
They do. And in fact, not a sure thing because, for instance, the 1997-98 El Nino, right, the largest one to record to date at 2.3 above centigrade, was a 3-bushel increase in the average trend yield or deviation from the average.
And I think the thing that's missing that we really didn't talk about in our article is that, particularly in these really big El Ninos, what they tend to predict pretty reliably is a major summer heat wave. Not a lot of predictability about precipitation. It's hard to connect that, but you're going to get probably next summer, the odds really favor a fairly significant heat wave, but the timing of it can be critical. For example, in 1997-98, we had a major heat wave, but it occurred very late, August, September, after the crop was already made. 82-83, another very comparable one. The heat wave came early and just fried the crop. So I think what we can say is it's probably going to be a much hotter than normal summer, and it's going to be depend on a combination of whether we get anything near normal precipitation, and when the heat hits will be what will determine what 2016 ultimately turns out to be.
And very quickly, then, the takeaway is that there is more risk in this year's production than there have been in previous years, based solely on the strength of the El Nino, and that that might show up as a premium at some point in the marketplace.
That's right. What's interesting is anyone watching the market prices could certainly tell that doesn't seem like there's much of this kind of enhanced yield risk is built into a weather premium in the marketplace. So despite these kind of facts, it'll be interesting to see as we go through the springtime if the market builds in any more weather premium or not.
Scott Irwin, thanks so much.
My pleasure, always.
Scott Irwin is an agricultural economist here on the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois. You can listen, of course, to this program again anytime you'd like on our website at willag.org. That's willag.org. When we come back, we'll talk with Daryl Good about his most recent posting to the Farm Doc Daily website. By the way, you can find the article on El Nino there as well. Daryl takes a look forward at the grain stocks report, which is due out at the end of this month.
It's Farmers Day. It's also National Peanut Cluster Day. On this day in agricultural history in 1717, Abraham Darby died, a British ironmaster. He first successfully smelted iron ore with coke, a much cheaper fuel than coal. The iron quality permitted thin castings that competed with those of brass in making pots. In 1824, John Elder was born, a Scottish marine engineer. He developed the compound steam marine engine. His model divided the steam expansion into two cylinders so that each cycled through a smaller range of temperatures and pressures, which greatly improved fuel efficiency. In 1923, the Coca-Cola 6-bottle carton was introduced. Coke's management hoped the new packaging would encourage people to take bottles of Coke home and drink it more often. The packaging was a huge hit with the public. And in 1992, Christian K. Nelson, inventor of the Eskimo Pie, died at the age of 99. Nelson says he received inspiration for the treat when a boy in a store was unable to decide whether to spend his limited money on ice cream or a chocolate bar. And that's this day in agricultural history.
Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible by Farm Credit Illinois, dedicated to improving the quality of life for Illinois farmers by offering financial products and services geared specifically to the farm community and developing partnership-based relationships with its agricultural customers, helping farm families succeed for 100 years.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report on a Tuesday afternoon. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. We're joined by Daryl Good, agricultural economist from the U of I. Now, of course, we just finished up the all-day ag outlook at the Beef House, so no weather forecast at this point. Daryl's here to talk about an article he posted to the website, Farm Doc Daily, yesterday, looking forward to the end of the month grain stocks report, in particular for corn. This is always an interesting one because now we'll be halfway through the marketing year, and grain stocks gives us a better idea of what feed usage looks like. There's not really any other way to calculate that, so you kind of take a look at what the history of this is and what it can tell us about feed usage in the United States.
No, that's exactly right, Todd. We look at what stocks are on March 1, what they were on December 1, and then you have a calculation of how much corn disappeared during the quarter. And then for exports and domestic processing uses, we use available data that's available from the USDA, Census Bureau, and others to calculate that. And so we then have a residual that went somewhere but was not exported or processed, and that goes into the feed and residual category. And so when we get the March 1 stocks number, we'll have that disappearance for the first half of the year. And then the challenge is, okay, what does that tell us, if anything, about where we're headed for the entire year? And one would hope that you could look back at the seasonal pattern that we've experienced historically and say, okay, what's typically the breakdown between what we use the first half of the year and what we use the second half? But what we find is that's not been a consistent pattern. And clearly, the 4 years prior to last year seemed to be an aberration where we were using much more in the feed and residual category during the first half of the year. Last year, we kind of reverted back to the previous pattern of, closer to 70% or less during the first half of the year. So what we're going to have to look at is, where does the stock number come in? What is the implied usage during the first half of the year? And what percentage do we think that is of the total for the year? And the starting point is to say, if we're progressing at the same seasonal pattern as we did last year, and the USDA is correct about using 5.3 billion bushels for the year, then we can get to the bottom line and say, if all of that is correct, March 1 stock should come in right at 7.8 billion bushels, which would be about 50 million bushels larger than stocks of a year ago. So it'll be interesting to see how the market interprets that, because of the variance in the seasonal pattern that we've experienced, you could say that a stocks number really within 150 million bushels of 7.8 probably shouldn't change your mind that 5.3 billion feed use for the year is correct. We could come in larger stocks, smaller stocks, and still be on track. But I'm guessing that the market will react if we're seeing feed use much different than what we saw total during the first half of last year. There will be some market reaction to that.
So just to clarify, 150 million bushels on either side, so a 300 million bushel swing from one end to the other. This is due out, of course, on the 31st day of March, and it will come out probably overshadowed, I suspect, by the acreage figures.
It typically is. If there's really no major surprise in the stocks number, and there hasn't been for a while, then I think all the attention will be on how many acres producers intend to plant this year.
Daryl Good, University of Illinois agricultural economist. I'm U of I Extension's Todd Gleason.